From Washington, D.C., National Public Radio presents an address by Senator Edward M. Kennedy, Democrat of Massachusetts. Senator Kennedy spoke to the Washington Press Club. His topic, challenges facing the Congress and the nation in 1972. His address is followed by a question and answer period. Here now, Senator Edward Kennedy.
I'm honored to be with you this evening and to have the opportunity to address the Washington Press Club on what I see as the major challenges facing Congress and the nation in 1972. This is the time of year to assess the state of our national spirit, a spirit now in crisis. It is a crisis of performance, as we see our government unable to manage the economy, and American business and labor subjected to withering competition from foreign nations. It is a crisis of violence, for even as the fires of urban riot that so disfigured America a few years ago seem of late to have been banked, yet the violent impulse that gave them birth has survived, broken into a million tiny ripples, 100 daily murders, 10,000 assaults, and uncounted other crimes by Americans against their fellow citizens. It is a crisis of morality and idealism, which sees us still heaping destruction on a small and alien land, even as we see terrible cruelties in our own country, so that the names of My Lai and Kent State and Attica are seared forever into the American soul. This cumulative crisis of the spirit is felt by us in many different ways. There can be few who do not feel it at all. And however we analyze the causes of our present concern, we share a common judgment. This is not why we labored in our fathers' sacrifice. This is not why men served and martyrs died. This is not why we raised such hopes when the decade of the 60s began such a few short years ago. The crisis is not the creation of any single man, nor was it manufactured by the administration now in power. But if our current difficulties run deeper than any single administration, they also show how much we need direction from the top. In times like these, the American people have traditionally turned to their president for leadership. They demand a sense of national purpose and inspiration they can identify with, participate in, be proud of. For above all, they have a deep and profound sense of belonging to this country and its historic purpose. That sense of purpose is what we must find, what we must struggle to recapture. The first and most important issue, the one that leads all the rest, is the issue of the war. It may be true that Vietnam is not so desperate a problem now as it was 3 years ago. Our involvement on the ground has been reduced. Our troops are coming home. And this is an obvious improvement over the policies of previous years. But the war has also been extended into Laos and Cambodia, and now perhaps to Thailand. And no one thinks that the bombing is winding down. These foreboding signs illuminate the paradoxes of our policy. We are withdrawing, but not completely. The South Vietnamese are at least able to defend themselves, but American forces must stay on to help. The war is largely on the ground, but our ultimate answer is still from the air. If ever a president was elected to end a war, to wash away the stain brought on us by Vietnam, Richard Nixon was elected for that purpose. With far less outcry in the nation at the time, President Eisenhower vowed to end the Korean War in the campaign of 1952. And by 1954, America was at peace. Now 4 years have passed since 1968. 20,000 more Americans have died, and still the war goes on. We know that the monstrous bombing will continue. We know that thousands of soldiers of North and South Vietnam and tens of thousands of innocent men and women and children will die in Indochina in 1972 for the simple reason that President Nixon will not allow the Saigon government to falter until he is secure at home for another term of office. I believe there is no more to the discussion of Vietnam than that. The regime of President Chu is nothing but a minor trapping of American power, a regime that, when we leave Vietnam, will immediately wash away in the stench of its own inconsequence and incompetence and corruption. It is for this that Americans and Asians still die, for this that American bombs still ravage four small nations, for this that American prisoners still rot in Hanoi. President Nixon holds the key to release the prisoners in his hand as surely as he held the key that released James Hoffa last December. And the sooner he unlocks the door, the better. Let us end completely every aspect of our military involvement in Vietnam once and for all. Let us abandon every one of the false dreams that led us into that swamp. Let us admit that all men make mistakes, and so do nations, and that we are large and courageous enough to disdain false pride, repair our errors, and seek the path of decency once again. The failure of our Vietnam policy is matched only by the shame of our policy towards India and Pakistan. Intoxicated by the acclaim at home for the magnificent new policy toward China, in debt to Pakistan for her assistance in launching the new policy, the administration shut its eyes to months of brutality and repression in Bangladesh, while India staggered under the burden of millions of refugees crossing her border to escape the killing. We failed our very history when we allied ourselves with the cruel effort to halt the birth of a nation that had voted to be born. And then, when the provocation was too great and India struck back, the administration finally spoke, but in cruel words that called India the sole aggressor in the conflict and left Pakistan absolved of any blame. The India-Pakistan war has become the Achilles heel of the Nixon foreign policy. It demonstrates how warped our policy really is, how prostrate towards Peking our policy has become. Of course, the president deserves great credit for his new approach to China. The policy is right towards China. And let us pray that history does not tell us that the price we paid was wrong because we lost sight of other nations and deeper values. Let us not be led astray by our morbid preoccupation with Vietnam or our newfound fascination with Peking. Let us sound instead a new theme in American foreign policy. Let us return to the reality of who we are and what we are supposed to be. A nation born of revolution, a nation of immigrants, a nation of people in love with the pure idea of freedom. The treaties and alliances of the past have served us well, but they were designed for a bygone era. An era as obsolete as our China policy used to be. The world has now moved on, and America is being left behind. We should tell the world that we are the friend of individual worth and human dignity, the enemy of poverty and pestilence and disease and malnutrition. If in this new day we need Greece to stand against Russia, if we need Arab oil when the life of Israel is at stake, if we need Portugal to arrange our summits, if we need Pakistan to get to China, if we need dictators to preserve our interests in Latin America, if we need chrome from Rhodesia and sugar from South Africa, if we stand silent before torture in Brazil and Northern Ireland, then we do not understand the direction of the world. We deny our heritage. We deny our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. Let us ask the American people this year a simple question. With whom do we wish our government to keep faith at this crossroad leading into the final quarter of the century? The few whose power stems from tyranny and oppression, or the billions who seek a decent life of hope and freedom for their children? I have faith in the answer of our people. Together, let us share the pride of a policy for the people of this world, a policy that puts America where our soul and our traditions tell us we should be. We are accustomed to being perplexed by the world beyond our borders. But in the past decade, we have come to a sense that we do not understand even our own society or even our own selves. And yet the central issue of domestic policy is really quite a simple one. Are we going to have a government that is responsive to the people or only to the special interests? Do we want welfare only for Lockheed and the giant farmers and not for those who live in poverty? Shall we spend our dollars on a space shuttle and an SST for the few to fly the heavens, when the many here on Earth have simple unmet needs like home and schools and health? How can we have confidence of the people if we have leaders who stand squarely with the insurance industry and the American Medical Association against health reform, with the National Rifle Association against gun control, with the oil industry against tax reform, with the highway lobby against mass transit? These are the sort of questions we have to ask, because they cut across all the specific issues now before us. And once the people understand and begin to stir, we shall end this era of trouble and discontent and rediscover the meaning of government by the people. Together, then, let us examine six great issues for America in 1972. Let us ask what the government has said and done, and let us ask what the people want. We begin with the economy. No one disagrees that the overriding domestic issue of the year will be our economic strength. We know that a sound economy is the greatest social program America has ever had, the foundation on which all other goals depend. And only by solving the problems of the economy can we buy the time we need to meet the great domestic issues of our day. Yet the problems of phase two and the actions of the government fill none of us with confidence that the administration means to persevere if the merits of the issue prove inconvenient as the campaign plans unfold. And if the job is abandoned before the work is done, we will pay for years to come for marching this nation up and down the hill of wage and price controls. In the area of unemployment, the promise is no better. The administration meets the problem with excuses instead of programs. They are quick to explain why things go wrong, but slow to make any effort to anticipate or solve the problem. Again and again, we hear the explanations as they attempt to shift the blame. They blame this, they blame that. They blame the returning veterans from Vietnam. They blame women in the labor force. They even blame the teenagers. They blame everyone but themselves. And all the people want is jobs, but they are ignored and unemployed. The next great issue for the nation is the crisis of our cities. There are some who believe that because the cities are not burning, their problems can be ignored. I think they are misleading the nation and themselves. How can the administration turn its back on housing for the inner cities? How can they freeze $1 billion for the cities and shut off the meager rescue that Congress tried to send last year? Is it just so that the flow of funds can be restored in 1972? The people know the need, and they know that tomorrow is too late. Today, the cities of the nation are tense with poverty and despair, full of housing built for the wave of immigrants a century ago, public facilities that are overcrowded and understaffed, streets that are choked with traffic, parks decayed, human values lost in the desperate search for food and clothing and health and housing that people need to live. Decade of the 70s should be a decade of reconstruction for urban America, a decade of concerted effort to end the shameful conditions that exist. Without changing a single piece of federal legislation, but simply by directing dollars to our real priorities, we can begin that reconstruction. If we can build new suburban satellites in Maryland and Virginia, surely we can also build new cities in Harlem and Roxbury and Watts and Woodlawn and Atlanta and Anacostia, and do all the other things we have to do to make our cities whole. The third great issue for the nation is the choice we face on welfare. The most tragic aspects of the legislation now before the Congress are the appeal it has to those for whom the politics of poverty means another chance to push the poor around, and the appeal it has to those who are so insulated from the problems of the poor that they do not really understand the despair that poverty can bring. What sense does it make in an economy with unemployment at 6.1% to require people to look for work that does not exist? What sense does it make to tell the poor that they can have food and clothing and housing, but only if they register for jobs that are not there? What sense does it make to talk so much of work when 70% of the people who need welfare are the blind, the halt, the lame, the very young, and others who cannot work at all? What sense does it make that a president so hostile to the bureaucracy of phase two now wants a massive new bureaucracy to force the poor to work? Jobs are the key to welfare, but not the way the administration means. What we need is a serious national program to create the jobs that are so desperately needed by white and black America. Not make work, but real jobs. Not at poverty pay, but at pay that enables a man to hold his family together and bring hope to the dreams his children have. The problem is the same for engineers laid off in Florida and California as it is for blacks in any urban ghetto. When a family has no job, it has no money. It cannot meet its daily needs in areas like health and nutrition and education and housing. The family itself begins to disintegrate. Crime begins to flourish. Whole communities begin to die. If all we do is enact a bill like H.R. 1, as the administration wants, we shall have a law that is primitive in philosophy, pitiless in its substance, and punitive in practice. We shall be creating a permanent pauper class of the American population, forever estranged from their fellow citizens, living not as the rest of us, by the labor of their own hands and minds, but by a meager computerized assistance check. Generations of our children will be reared, not in independence as free Americans, but under the constant watchful eye of the government bureaucracy. That is not the true path of the American spirit, and it's not the path that Congress should travel in 1972. The fourth great issue is on health. If you think we have a system that is working well today, ask the person next to you. Ask a mother who tries to call a doctor after dark. Ask a man who lost his health insurance because he lost his job. Ask a senior citizen whose Medicare is run out. Ask anyone who ever paid a bill or tried to file a health insurance claim. Our people will never get fair value for their enormous investment in health care unless we break the stranglehold of the health providers and the health insurance companies. We have a mammoth health care crisis because we have a mammoth health care system that works well only for the few. It works well for the doctors. It works well for the hospitals. It works well for the insurance industry. It works well for everyone but the sick. And it is the people who pay the price for this enormous profiteering. They have been sold a bill of goods for a system that is marred throughout by high cost and inefficiency, by inconvenience and incompetence, and by implicit or outright fraud. I do not believe that Congress will be a party to the passage of any health insurance bill that maintains such vital flaws. We stand on the threshold of real reform. 1972 can be the year when we cross that threshold and fulfill at last the promise that health is a basic right for all our citizens, not just an expensive privilege for the few. Fifth great issue for the nation is the challenge to redirect the energies of science. For a generation, science in America has thrived on defense and outer space. Our triumphs have been legends, and we have become strong beyond our deepest dreams or needs. Now we have other dreams and have other needs to meet. Needs that go by the names like health and education and crime and poverty and transportation and drug control. Because the needs are great, we can no longer afford the luxury by which we focus science elsewhere and depend on spin-offs to meet our basic social goals. Who dares to claim that the promise of science is even remotely matched by its performance? When we propel nuclear aircraft carriers around the globe on a bucket full of fuel, yet our cities are plagued by blackouts. When we harvest more crops per acre than our ancestors could cultivate for miles around, yet millions of our children live in hunger or die of malnutrition. Let us commit ourselves to narrow the awful gap between potential and reality in modern American science. And if we do, then the resulting benefits will accrue to all the people for generations to come. The last great issue is on race. With the possible exception of foreign policy, nothing I have mentioned so far is as vital to the long-run well-being of the nation as the direction we choose on race. Americans are a decent people, and they want to do the decent thing. They do not like to think that we are a racist society, and they do not like to hear it said. And yet, if a man or a woman is young and gifted and black in America, he knows that his dreams have different boundaries, and he knows that now, for the first time in his life, those boundaries have stopped expanding. Examine the record of six modern presidents. and you see how the march of history has been halted. Franklin Roosevelt built the first true coalition that embraced black Americans as members of society. He restored their faith that the nation could reach out to its weakest citizens. Harry Truman ordered the end of segregation in the armed forces of the nation. Dwight Eisenhower proposed the first substantial Civil Rights Act since the Civil War. He founded the Civil Rights Division in the Department of Justice as a monument to his concern. He stood with Earl Warren in the Supreme Court against the darkness that threatened to consume Little Rock and the nation in the wake of the historic school decision. John Kennedy stood with Martin Luther King and proposed the most sweeping civil rights legislation in our history, the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Lyndon Johnson presided over the enactment of that bill and then went on to sponsor his own historic measure, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And now, in the fourth year of the presidency of Richard Nixon, the chain is broken. The progress has stopped. There are no achievements to cite. 25 million black Americans are starving for the bread of hope and notice, and all they have from the administration is cake, with names like Carswell, benign neglect, and opposition to every meaningful civil rights bill that Congress tries to pass. In American history, you have to go back to the era of Reconstruction to find a comparable abdication by the federal government of its responsibilities for civil rights. Black America lies becalmed today, halfway between hope and desperation. And unless the administration acts more positively now, it will be a wiser man than I who could predict the direction we shall move when the wind begins to blow again. Let us restore the promise and sense of progress we used to have before it is too late. Let us resume the work our friends and brothers began. And perhaps in 1976, when we meet to celebrate the Declaration of Independence, we can read those brief immortal words that all men are created equal and be able to persuade black America that when it says all, it means all. As these remarks have shown, the list of our goals in foreign and domestic affairs is large, and it is large because we have left so much undone. Our present difficulties do not flow, I think, so much from the fact that people mistrust their government as from the fact that the government so obviously mistrusts the people. And yet today, as so often in the past, the people are far ahead of the politicians. It was not government, but the people themselves who began the civil rights movement and the drive for women's rights. It was not government, but the people themselves who discovered poverty and hunger in America. It was not government, but the people themselves who first sensed our failure in Vietnam and who know today that the war's continuation is nothing but a waste. Time and again, it is the people who have shown the greatest wisdom and judgment. All they ask is a leader to inspire their efforts and coordinate their actions. It is now more than 10 years since John Kennedy told us to ask not what our country could do for us, but what we could do for our country. That was a phrase and a feeling that fired the imagination of an entire generation of Americans and of people around the world. For all our citizens, rich and poor, north and south, business and labor, we brought a new awareness of the purpose of America, brought a new respect for our basic civil liberties. We brought a new compassion to the strong. We brought new hope to all the weak and to the poor and the black and the Indian and the Chicano and the small farmer in our rural counties. I believe that government can still inspire the people. That is what we need once more. And let us list again the energies and talents of our citizens, especially our young, and the great public enterprises of the American nation. The idealism we had before may be just a spark today, but it is still there, waiting for the call that can fan it back to life. Perhaps in closing, we can appreciate our need by considering the name Charles Thompson. Charles Thompson recently pleaded guilty in New York to manslaughter in the first degree. He shot a cab driver he was trying to rob when the man put up an unexpected fight. Before sentencing, the judge received a probation report. Charles Thompson, it seems, has only one leg. He lost the other at Quezon. He also has a heroin addiction that he acquired at an army hospital in Japan. He returned to the United States, as have so many of our veterans, without adequate education or job training, crippled and addicted, without any prospect or hope of employment. His disability pay was inadequate to support his habit, so he did the only thing he was trained to do. He used a gun. The judge was compassionate. He could not just release this dangerous man. He had to think of the next cab driver. So he called agency after agency, state and federal and local and private, trying to find any place or person who would accept responsibility for treating Charles Thompson under appropriate safeguards. There was none. No one would take him in. And so 2 days before Thanksgiving of 1971, Charles Thompson was sentenced to serve up to 25 years in Attica State Prison. That story sums up something of what we have done to the bright promise of the American nation. It measures our misguided policies of the recent past and their survival in the present. It measures the failures of our society, the imperfections of our justice, the extent of our insensitivity to the suffering of our fellow citizens. And most of all, it illuminates our helplessness, our seeming inability to do what we know is right, what we know we have the capacity to accomplish. That is the flagging spirit we can and must revive for ourselves and for the future of our children. For in the last analysis, to live peacefully and decently as a nation, we need a certain kind of moral order, a certain kind of social and political order, an order based on things like hope and work and faith and love, the age-old virtues that built America in the past. That is the challenge of leadership we face today, and that is what 1972 is all about.
Thank you very much, Senator Kennedy. And now the senator will take questions. Would you please identify yourself and give us time after you're recognized to repeat the question up here, because very often the working press in the front can't be heard in the back of the room.
Bill Hines of the Chicago Sun-Times, you have outlined what we might call six crises here, and you've mentioned health as number four. I'm wondering what you believe, not hope, but realistically believe, will come out in terms of health legislation from this Congress.
What will come out? Health legislation from this Congress, not what I hope, but what I believe. I would think some catastrophic health insurance and what you might call kiddie care, the beginning of the program to apply to young people. I would expect the next step would be to bracket in the elderly and then eventually the total population. I'm concerned that if just catastrophic health insurance is achieved, it may very well blunt the more important effort to reform the total system, and I think there's a real danger of that. Yes, sir.
Marianne Means.
Marianne Means,
the question is, are there any circumstances which I'd accept the vice president nomination? No, they're not. The same reasons I'm not a candidate for the presidency. Yes, ma'am. Well, I am for amnesty. I start off with the from the position that if, as I understand, all of the members of My party and the leading candidates have recognized that the war is a mistake and a fundamental mistake and have deplored their positions in the past, then I think the next sentence is a recognition that the young people who've expressed their views in opposition to the war, in some instances are enduring even prison sentences, and in other instances have left their families and their communities and their countries, which they love because they have felt a sufficient outrage of the war. The next sentence is that they were right and the political leaders were wrong. And I don't see what useful purpose it is to try and establish some false mechanism, which I think would be a mistake, to welcome them back. I think As one of the themes I mentioned this evening is the question of reconciliation in this country. It's the reconciliation between the black and the white and the north and the south and the old and the young. And it's recognition, reconciliation between those that have been scarred by this country because they have left this nation with those that have remained and made a mistake in supporting a misguided policy. And these young people will be known in their communities and known in their families for what they have done. And I think one way of beginning to put this country back together again is to grant the amnesty. Yes, sir.
Mary Shelley, at first, are there any Democratic presidential candidates that you would not
support? Yes. Are there any Democratic candidates that I could not support? The answer to that is yes.
Senator, may I follow that with a question?
I'm not so sure.
Have you or any members of your family made any contributions to any Democratic candidate, and if so, whom?
Well, I can speak for myself. I don't know about Mother. You know, she since 1968 when she was. No, I don't. Eunice, I'm sure, hasn't. No, but I don't believe any of them have. Yes. No, they haven't, I'm sure. Go ahead.
There was a report today that you
Now, the question is, there was a story that I telephoned Senator McGovern to congratulate him for the support he received on the caucus over the weekend, and does it indicate any favoritism towards his candidacy? I did congratulate him, but I'm not, I'll congratulate the winner of the Massachusetts primary as well. I have a very high regard for Senator McGovern. I'll also telephone whoever wins the Massachusetts primary. Yes, sir.
Bill Hines of the Sun-Times again, sir. There, for some inconceivable reason, was no follow-up question to the earlier one on any Democrats who you would not support.
Yeah. I was trying to find out if he... No, I would... I think George Wallace, obviously, if he's runs in the... as a member of the Democratic Party, I understand he has filed... I would not support. I'd say, with regard to the other candidates, I intend to support the nominee. There are some that I could support more enthusiastically than others. I'm hopeful that in the course of the primaries themselves, that all of them are going to sharpen their own positions as in terms of some of these matters and the other matters that we have before the country. Yes, sir.
Saul Fuller, New House newspaper. Senator, you say that the spark is waiting to be fanned back to life. Can you tell us then why aren't you one who would fan it?
Well, the question is, if the spark is there to be fanned back to life, why aren't I there to fan it? I've indicated, I think, frequently why I'm not a candidate. I repeat it very briefly here. I think I have important family responsibilities, which I think are the first responsibilities that I have, and it's for that reason I'm not a candidate. But I'm going to be active in my party affairs. I'm going to speak out on the issues. I'm going to travel this country and work with the National Democratic Committee to help raise funds for the national ticket. I'll speak at registration rallies, and I'll speak and testify on the platform committee. I hope to be able to make some useful contribution in shaping the platform of my party and the direction that the nominee will take in addressing himself to the needs here at home and throughout out the world. So I'm intending to be extremely active, but I don't see being in the form of a candidacy.
One follow-up question here. In the high school audience in Massachusetts last week, You were reported to have said the Watchman in 1977.
Now, that was the... I was asked whether I would run, consider running sometime in the future, and I indicated that in response to that question, that I'd hope to be able to continue in the Senate and play a role for the future of the my own party, and that I'd learned well enough not to plan extensively on the future, and as far as future left. Questions or future years, we'll just have to wait to see. It was used in that context. Yes, sir.
Jim Wehar. Jim Wehar, New York Daily News. What role, Senator, does the accident at Chappaquiddick have to play in your decision not to be a candidate this year?
Well, the question is the role of the accident at Chappaquiddick in terms of my own decision not to be a candidate. I've experienced a number of personal tragedies, of which I consider the Chappaquiddick accident to be one, which has involved my family, involved my brothers, and also involved Chappaquiddick. And I feel that the prime reasons for not running is because of responsibilities to my family, and that is the overriding issue and question in my mind. It's for that reason that I'm not a candidate.
Senator, did you promise your mother and your wife that you would not run for president?
Do I have to tell them, Joan? Do I have to tell them? I kind of hinted to my mother, and I promised her. No, no, I haven't. There you go.
Clifford Evans of RPO, yes. General Broadcasting. Keeping in mind all the Democratic possibilities that you would support, can Richard Nixon be defeated in 1972, and for which reasons?
Well, the question is, can President Nixon be defeated, and for what and for which reasons? I believe that he can be defeated. I think the real test is going to be whether the Democratic Party over these next few months is able to develop the candidate who is going to present the unmet needs of this country in as clear and as precise terms as I think the American people expect, and be able to also express some constructive and positive views on how best to meet those needs, both in terms of domestic policy and in foreign policy. I think that's very likely to take place, and I'm going to work in every way that to ensure that it does. So I'm very hopeful and optimistic. I think we've looking at it in a from the point of view of just a raw statistics, with the 25 million young Americans, of which about 6.5 million have registered at this time, I think it's fair to say that another 6.5 or 7 million will probably register, as the conservative estimate. I think there's a very good opportunity that of those 12, 13 million that are registered, 10 million might vote. Break down 5-3 Democratic, which is not an unreasonable judgment, particularly, once again, if the party is responsive on the issues. And given those that voted for Vice President Humphrey in 1968, and I don't see any strong reason why people who voted for Senator Humphrey or Vice President Humphrey in 1968 would not vote for the nominee in 1972, I think the prospects from this point of view are favorable. I'd say even extremely favorable from that second vantage point. Thirdly, if you look at the track record of the president in other elections, I can look back to 1960, where he was 10 points ahead of President Kennedy, lost that election in a narrow contest. He was 21 points ahead of Governor Brown in 1962. He lost that contest. He was 14 points ahead of Vice President Humphrey with the two most emotional issues of our time, which was the war and the civil rights issues, and in the wake of the debacle in Chicago, and came within a whisper of losing that with the expenditures of about $32 or $34 million. Now he's only a few points ahead of any one of a number of the Democratic nominees, all of whom I think will probably move up in the, in public esteem as the primaries they have an opportunity to be considered more seriously in the primaries, and they have a chance to have their views more fully developed. So I would think the prospects are good. Finally, let me say that just speaking from the point of view of my own state, I find enormous frustration about the economic policies and the unemployment issues. People are deeply concerned about foreign policies and the success of a China trip and the reduction of tensions, and hopefully the SALT talks will be successful and there'll be the beginning of the talks in Europe on the mutual force reduction and all the other marvelous things. But ultimately, it's will be the economic issues, and I fail to see, given the approach that we have at the present time, where there's a very significant prospect that the economy will be righted again. So I think for all of these reasons, the president is vulnerable, and there's a good chance for the Democratic Party.
How much is any chance that you will be voting more progressive?
Yes. The question, will I be voting progressively, is that's the word on the Equal Rights Amendment, and the answer is more progressive. The answer is yes.
Does that mean that you will support an Equal Rights Amendment that is not diluted?
Well, it means that I'd vote for the Equal Rights Amendment now that's been introduced by Senator Bayh. I think we've had, there's been, I think, two very significant changes over the period of the last several months. First of all, the EEOC, the Title VII of the 64 Civil Rights Act, which had been amended in the Labor Committee to provide cease and desist powers against discrimination in employment, and would have covered a wide variety of employment opportunities, obviously, was completely watered down in the House, and the Republican substitute was accepted in the House, which eliminated the cease and desist powers as it would have applied to for women's rights. And I think the given that and the position of the administration, it's unlikely that that can be restored. I'll make every effort that I can have in the past for it in the Senate. Hopefully we can show the good wisdom of it, but that failed in the House. Secondly, I was disappointed in the Idaho decision case, which first extended the 14th Amendment rights to women, first time in approximately 30-odd years, 35 years, and the narrowness of its findings. I thought, given the Supreme Court and extending the 14th Amendment widely and broadly in terms of equal rights, would have effectively vitiated any necessity for the amendment that's being considered on the floor. That decision by the Supreme Court, I think, was narrow. Hopefully it'll be broad enough and wide enough to knock down much of the discrimination against women, but it's still much narrower than I expected or would have hoped for the Supreme Court. So for these reasons, I'll support. I think there are some provisions of it, some limitation of the amendment. I mean, the amendment itself only applies to federal estate action. It's actually a rather limited type of amendment. Doesn't apply to private action, private employment. And so it's really only a small, it's a small, but I think it can be useful and it is important, and I intend to support it. Yes, Don.
You said that President Nixon, John Herling, National Newspaper Syndicate, President Nixon holds the key, you say, to release the prisoners, American prisoners, in his hands. I assume that is not just a figure of speech. What is that key? What would you do if you were president?
Well, the question relates to a part of the speech refers to the fact that the president, statement that the president has the key for the release of the prisoners. And what do I think is the key to their release? I think the key to their release is the stating clearly and precisely that on a time definite we're going to be out of Vietnam lock, stock, and barrel. That's been the position that has been stated by the other side in the July last at the Paris peace negotiations. It was repeated to Mr. Hope in his recent visit, I guess, to Vientiane some 5 weeks ago. And the question that I'm sure that every mother of every son who remains in a prison camp in Hanoi and every son and daughter that his father is missing is why this administration and the president doesn't follow the Mansfield type of amendment, and the state will have all American troops out at a given time, assuming that the other side will release American prisoners. I mean, why not take them at their word? Why not test their position? What's so extraordinarily baffling about or complicated or threatening to the United States position to take them at their word? The response that any of us ever get is that we're testing, probing through diplomatic channels and other nations' capitals around the world. We've heard that for far too long, and I'm convinced that by setting the time definite, we would begin to bring the Americans home at a pace which was related to the withdrawal of American prisoners. But still, we don't have any of that assurance. And as a matter of fact, we do have the assurance to the contrary, that American prisoners will remain in Hanoi as long as Americans remain in South Vietnam. And we have the statements of our Secretary of Defense that indicates that there will be a residual force remaining in South Vietnam. I think we in this country or matter of policy ought to test that. And I believe that that is the key. And I can't understand, and I don't believe that the American people will understand by November of this year of why it isn't put in the lock and the American prisoners set free.
In setting that date for withdrawal, would you accompany that by a statement of no more military or economic aid?
The question is, any more military or economic aid? I wouldn't have any more military or economic aid. What you're interested in, and what, or at least what I would hope, is true negotiations. I mean, we talk about a political settlement, and as long as we've provided $8 billion alone to this government, last since 65 through 71. And if, I don't know how many more billions of dollars one should expect that we'd provide. What you're really interested in doing is the true political process taking place. And that is that Chu is going to consider the significance of the Wa Hao's, or the Cao Dai's, or the Buddhists, and balance that against the other groups, the Catholics, and try and put together a representative, if he can. If he can't, there's going to be others who will do it. And we ought to recognize that right now. Because there's nothing that any president has said that says that we're committed to this present administration. Mr. Chu, yes. Ms. Chen.
You claim that you're out of hand.
Yes.
How do you explain that you're in the field of planning a program?
Well, the question is, I'm saying that I'm not a candidate, and yet I'm planning speeches across the country. That's exactly right. I'm not a candidate, but I'm very much concerned about what's happening in this country. I have a responsibility to the people who elected me to the United States Senate to speak on these issues and questions. I feel myself that as long as I can be of help and assistance in as I mentioned, moving my party or helping to draw attention to some of these issues, I have every intention to do so. By being not a candidate doesn't mean that I'm out of public life or out of public service. Quite to the contrary.
Senator, could you tell us which of the other Democratic candidates you feel might carry out the program you have laid out tonight?
Well, the question is which of the other candidates may carry out these programs. I'm not prepared at this time to make that judgment. I'd hope that in the course of the primaries that we'd probably get a clearer idea as to who is willing and how important they feel. And also, I'm sure we'll find their sense of priorities. Obviously, this isn't an exclusive list. They didn't talk about many of the other issues or questions. Didn't get into the tonight and talking about the rural poverty or the problems of the Indians. We didn't talk about the senior citizens, how they've been left out of our society. There's a great number of different areas. So I don't say that this is the list. There are many other areas and whole environment issues and questions, too. But I would hope that in all of these matters, not limited here to what I've said tonight, but in this whole area that we're going to have greater attention.
Given the recent disclosure of the Pentagon Papers and the Anderson Papers, I'd like to know to what extent you feel the American people are entitled to the memorandum on decision-making.
The question is, given the revelations of the Anderson Papers, do I believe that American people are entitled to the memorandum of understanding? Yes, I do. The results of this conversation didn't surprise me or startle me one bit. As one who's followed the development of the events in India, Pakistan, I mean the proclivity of this administration to identify with Yahya Khan and to support Pakistan should not have really come as any a great surprise to anyone who'd follow the situation. They continued military aid at a time when the greatest atrocity that that man has committed against man and since the end of World War II was being committed. And there wasn't one time when a high administration official spoke out about the humanitarian needs in India. There wasn't one time that a high administration condemn the violence and the repression and the brutality in East Bengal. Not once. And it was being written by every news broadcast, by every newspaper writer, and by shown almost nightly by every television commentator, and was perfectly available to anyone that visited that part of the country. In hospital after hospital, in refugee camp after refugee camp, child after child had been bayoneted, woman after woman had been shot, continuing not in just the violence of March 25th, but continuing week after week and month after month. And still the United States did not condemn this kind of violence or repression. 4,300 children a day dying in the refugee camps. 4,300 children a day under the age of 8 dying in the refugee camps. And then tanks begin to go across a border and you talk about violence? I mean, there wasn't, I don't believe, either. And so why should we be so bewildered at the startled attitude of India when they say that, that the United States was identifying with Pakistan? It was just as clear as could be. And so when the great revelation came about the fact that this administration was favoring Yahya Khan, the government of West Pakistan, it should have been quite apparent. Now, the fact about the release of that material, I think it should be. It doesn't endanger a single American life. I think it's helpful and useful for all of us to know in the decision-making process. And I think it probably helps and all of us understand the isolation, which I think is a part of all of us, whether it's the president or the member of Congress in making these decisions. I think that's part of the tragedy.
Before the senator takes his last question, I wonder if I could ask you to clarify one earlier question, sir. I don't think that you were quite clear on your position on the Equal Rights Amendment. When the Senate voted on this amendment earlier, you voted against the undiluted version as it came over from the House, as sponsored by Representative Martha Griffiths. Are you telling us that you
would vote for it?
You voted for it with an amendment.
No,
now you're telling us you will vote for it.
I'll vote for it, yes.
You've changed your position.
I've changed.
One last question.
It's taken all that. Mr. Stiles. Bruce Stiles.
You've given us a list this evening of the nation's ills. If there were only one campaign problem in 1972, what is the major campaign problem that we're going to be hearing the most about during the campaign?
Well, if there's one I've given sort of a list of the nation's ills. If there's one campaign problem that we'll be hearing about, I don't know if you want the one that we'll be hearing or the one I believe, which I think is really basic and fundamental, is something which I touched on in the beginning of the speech and at the end, and that's the sense of fear and frustration and almost despair in the country. It's the fear of the worker losing his job or not being able to get any unemployment or any employment. It's the fear of the businessman about the market. It's the fear of the white that the blacks are moving into the community and that the blacks are going to raid them and shoot them down. It's the fear of the young that we're going to continue on ad infinitum in Vietnam without any end in sight, and elections don't mean anything because they elected somebody who said he had a plan to end the war in 1968, and the war goes on. And that maybe something worse will take place in other parts of the... it's the fear of the old people that the Congress will never act responsibly in trying to provide a decent social security bill and will maintain the ceiling so that they can't earn a decent wage to help themselves. It's a real fear that government in this country is in the hands of the special interests that don't really have the concern and the sensitivity to what this country is all about to try and to bring about the change. And I fear that that's the thing that has to be turned around in this nation. I think it can be, and I think it has to be. And I'm going to try and work in every way that I possibly can to ensure that it does. Thank you.